Great to have you with us today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we sort of mark the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act being put into place. We're going to be doing a monthly segment featuring a different animal that is protected or some aspect of the act itself every month right now through to the end of the year. So I'm really looking forward to it. And first, we're going to zero in on bats with a couple of people. Dave Riddell is a bat ecologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's been with us a number of times. Dave, great to have you back.
Glad to be here, Larry. Thank you.
And with us for the first time, Lori Osterndorf, who directs the DNR's Endangered Resources Bureau. And Lori, great to have you with us as well. Thanks so much for coming by.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk before we talk about bats, I want to talk about the act itself, the Endangered Species Act. What led to its passage back in 1972?
Prior to 72, it was the federal government who became interested in whooping cranes, realizing there were 21 birds left, the rarest crane in the world, and that the government probably should take some action. So it was in 1966 the federal government passed their first endangered species law. Then it went on to realize there were other animals, for example, whales, that captured worldwide attention, and that another piece of the law, being commerce, was something that they were interested in. So that was another iteration of the federal law. And then by the early 70s, specifically 1972, states became interested, realized they had a role to play, and Wisconsin passed its law, and I should say almost unanimously, passed a law in 1972 to protect state-listed animals and plants.
And what has that act meant for a threatened wildlife nationwide, maybe, and certainly here in Wisconsin?
I mean, the biggest thing is that it really focused attention and it became a high priority for us. They created the Endangered Resources Program within the department. We have a review process whereby anything that is funded or permitted by the department takes a look at its implication or its impact on rare species. It's brought greater attention to animals like Bald Eagle Days in Sauk City so that we've really been able to accomplish a lot and actually take animals off the list.
Yeah, that's always great news. Well, we turn to bats for just a minute. Dave, well, let's talk about the basics. You and I have talked about this before on the show, but we've got, how many types of bats? Four in here in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, we got four cave bat species and three tree bats, so seven. Yeah. Possibly a couple more. We're still looking for them.
Where are they hiding, huh?
Exactly.
Oh, man. Well, what role do bats play? I know they eat a lot of insects.
In Wisconsin, that's all they do is eat insects and occasionally a spider or two. Worldwide, they eat just about everything you can imagine. There's primarily nectar-feeding bats, fruit-eating bats that seed disperse, the nectar-feeding bats pollinate, the insect-eating bats like we have here are important for agriculture and forestry, eat a lot of insect pests that damage crops, and just really doing a service out there on the landscape for free while everyone's sleeping.
Yeah, it's an amazing, I saw some just phenomenal figures. Numbers on in terms of what they save in terms of potential for damage and stuff.
Yeah.
It's like $1 billion or something.
Well, yeah, it's just recent report came out that looked at insect eating services of bats, what that provides just agriculture alone, not forestry or anything else. And in Wisconsin, it's anywhere from $658 million to over $1.5 billion per year. Annual cost avoidance savings that the bats are doing a service out there eating the pests. So that's huge. Nationwide, it's up to $54 billion per year.
Forget about purple martins, my goodness. I mean, bats will eat, their weight? A pregnant bat? I think I remember reading something that you wrote.
Yeah, lactating female will eat up to her body weight per night in insects. That's if you take your weight, multiply it by four, that's the number of quarter-pound cheeseburgers you'll need to eat in a night to match a bat.
Wow. I tell you what, you may have some questions for our guest today as we talk about the Endangered Species Act and zero in on bats. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question, a comment, or maybe you've got a cool bat photo you want to show us. Post that as well. Caller in La Crosse. Oh, here's an issue. Caller in La Crosse needs to take down a chimney, but he knows there are many bats inside. He doesn't want to harm the bats, but needs to tear it down. What should he do? I mean, this is not probably a good time to be doing that.
No, if there are bats in it, it would be big brown bats hibernating. I would probably want to ask the caller a few more questions of, are they in there right now? Does he know that? Probably a little difficult to tell because they're not moving in the winter. I would recommend he get some expert advice from a professional bat excluder. There's some in the La Crosse area. Don't choose an excluder that doesn't have any experience with bats. I would pick someone who specializes in it because they know where to look, know what to do, and can help you out. But if they're not in there now, shouldn't be a problem taking the chimney down. I would just, for the bats, when they come back, put up a few bat houses and give them some alternative places to roost.
And I know there's a company that's called Wisconsin Bat Specialists over in La Crosse that would be, since there's bat in the title, they may be a good a good company to contact, Wisconsin Bat Specialists. But there would be others as well. Mm-hmm. Cheryl in Beloit wonders, do Wisconsin bats act as pollinators? Do we have pollinators here?
No. Those are the nectar-feeding bats, and we don't have any in Wisconsin. You got to go all the way down to California, Arizona area, New Mexico to get any pollinating species.
Jessica in Sturgeon Bay has a question for you folks. Jessica, hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. How are you today?
Great, thanks for calling.
Fantastic. I have two questions. I've heard about this white nose syndrome or disease or fungus or something, and I'm wondering if you could touch on that basis. And in addition to it, I want to know what we can do to encourage bats in our area. I want more by my home.
Yeah. Dave Riddell, what do you think?
Well, white nose syndrome, yes, is a devastating disease. I think most people by now have heard about it. The word's been getting out on how devastating it is, in fact. There is roughly 46 bat species in North America. 25 of those bat species hibernate. And that is where the disease occurs, is during hibernation. So all of Wisconsin cave hibernating species, as well as any other cave hibernating species, is susceptible to white nose syndrome. And these bats congregate from thousands of square miles to a single location, where if the disease strikes, it can wipe out 95 to 100% of the entire population in a single year.
Oof.
Let's see, the other question, what can...
Jessica...
What we can do to encourage bats in my area. I've heard of bat boxes, but I've been told they don't work, and I'm just curious what I can do to encourage them in my yard, so to speak.
Well, bat houses can work, can't they?
Oh, yes, they work, and it's just like any other real estate, location, location, location. Mm-hmm. And I'd add on design. A lot of these garden centers sell bat houses that are way too small, aren't sealed. Basically, if you can find a good design, and put it up in the right location, if you're near enough water, you're going to have success. You can check out, DNR's website and get a link to the Wisconsin Bat Program. We've got plans in there on how to build them yourself, where to put them, and so forth.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Frieda Marie in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We having a lot of bats in our barn, and we also have parties in there. So are these bat droppings at any time, wet or dry, dangerous when I sweep them out?
There is always the possibility that histoplasmosis is a fungal spore present in large piles of guano, bird, bats, whatnot. If you've got large concentrations of it, it can be an issue.
I sweep them regularly out so they don't accumulate, but the floor is pretty covered underneath with lots of dropping.
If you're pretty vigilant on getting it cleaned up, I can't say for sure, but I would put a high probability that you're not in too much danger of the disease.
Then it's wet or dry?
More
dangerous?
It's when it's dry, it's more dangerous because you're going to kick up the spores more easily than if it's wet.
Because it's mostly dry. You know, I do it ever twice a year, maybe.
Well, what you can do is wear a dust mask, maybe some eye protection. One of the studies that came out was that most people, or I can't remember, a large number of people have already been exposed to histoplasmosis and have never suffered any effects. Some people, either the elderly or some young children, can get some respiratory problems. It's not a terribly serious disease, but something to be concerned about, and I'd recommend wearing a mask.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Mark and Lafarge, on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I've read a little bit about a genetically engineered mosquito that's going to be sterile and going to reduce the mosquito population. I hate mosquitoes, but I love the bats and the barn swallows on this farm, and the ecosystem seems to be in balance because I've miraculously sometimes gone a whole year on the farm and never gotten one mosquito bite. Not always.
No.
But I'm concerned about how this could crash the bat population. Has anyone looked at this? And since so many birds depend on mosquitoes, what are the implications of this? I mean, are we kind of opening up a Pandora's box and we don't know where we're going here?
Well, I don't know what the GMO Pandora's box looks like, but I can tell you the bats should do just fine. They do eat mosquitoes, thankfully, because a lot of us like them for that, but that's not all they eat. And I would say that's not even their main portion of their diet. Most species focus on more of the crop pests, the beetles, moths, midges out in the water, mayflies, etc. So while they do eat mosquitoes, if all the mosquitoes are gone, the bats would still be able to find something to eat.
Yeah, there we go. Talking about bats today and also talking about the Endangered Species Act. It's in its 40th year. It's the 40th anniversary this year. With our two guests, Dave Riddell, bat ecologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Lori Ostendorf, who directs the DNR's Endangered Resources Bureau. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my two guests from the Department of Natural Resources, Dave Riddell, Lori Ostendorf, talking about bats and also talking about the Endangered Species Act. So great to have them along, and thank you so much for listening in. Gary in Bosco Bell has a question for you, so let's move there. Hi, Gary. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome, Larry. I'd like to direct a question about endangered species to Lori. And I am aware of a site in southern Wisconsin here that was managed by the Bureau of Endangered Resources as a prairie remnant. And because of decisions that were made on the management of that site, there was an animal species there that was extirpated from that site. And I'm curious and concerned about in the future with cutbacks in the budget for the Bureau of Endangered Resources, and also cutbacks in staff, and the overwhelming obligation of the BER to manage these natural areas and all of the creatures that, call them home, many of those are either threatened or endangered. And if the DNR can't fulfill its obligations and these species become extirpated, who's responsible for that? If I go out and, fumigate a cave that's full of bats and kill all those bats, I'm responsible for that legally if they're endangered. And who's responsible for the extirpation of species on areas that are managed by the state?
It is true that diminishing funds have implicated our program, and I can't speak specifically to the property you're talking about, though, unless I were to ask you, do you know what the name of the property is and the animal that was extirpated?
Yes, it was the Moral Prairie, and the Regal Frittle area has been extirpated from that site, and it was a state-listed endangered species.
Mm-hmm. I know we're doing work on different types of management for Regal Frittle area, and I can't tell you exactly what the situation is on that prairie. I will say, though, that over the course of the last 10 years, that the donations that come into the Endangered Resources Program, which fund fully up to 25% of what we do, have gone down dramatically. And we are working our best to both market the program by coming on programs like this, selling more license plates. Everybody who buys either a wolf plate or a badger plate, that $25 a year comes directly to the program, and to encourage people to donate on their tax forms. That's coming up right now. Any donation, large or small, is important to us. You look for the loon on your state tax checkoff, and that donation is matched 100% by the state. So those are all important ways to help augment the budget that we have to work on endangered resources.
And that loon, I've looked for that loon every year. I don't think I've missed a year. I think every year I have contributed money to that program. And, you know, every year I'm contributing a bit, but then I also get the little notice that, oh, I can deduct that off my next year's taxes. So it's always a deduction. From the year before,
it's true.
It's always there as a deduction for the next year's taxes. So
the loon is the first you look for it. There are more and more tax checkoffs, which is probably one of the reasons that we're getting fewer donations. But the loon is always the one on top because we were the first checkoff.
The first one's there. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's good to have the first best idea.
Thanks, Gary, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give others a chance to join in here. Steve in Montreal, Wisconsin. We turn to you next. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. This is beautiful, snowy Montreal to you people that live down in the tropics. We've had about a foot so far of beautiful snow this morning.
Oh, wonderful.
I mean, gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. But bats. I'm from Indiana and retired up here in Paradise. I know we've got some bats up here. You see them occasionally at night. I've had one or two float into the house when the door was open, and I chased them out. And I know they're great to scarf down mosquitoes, but what kind of bats are they? And I suppose with all the old mining area that we had up here, I suppose they're down in our caved-in kind of areas. There's not supposed to be any of the shafts open, but probably there are. What do we have here? What am I looking at?
Well, in the summer, it could be any of our species, but specifically what bats are up there in the mines would be one of four. The big brown bat, little brown bat, northern long-eared bat, or the eastern pipistrel. So those four species use caves and mines for hibernation. And, yeah, up in Montreal area, there was a lot of iron mining, turn of the century, last one, and there's a large number of underground voids where bats can hibernate. However, when mining shut down, so did the pumps that pumped out the water. So a lot of these sites have flooded. Some were filled or capped, and there's very few remaining up there suitable for bats. But if you find any, give me a call.
Well, they're up here occasionally, and I let them go their way, and I go mine, and I don't want to interfere with them.
There you go, Steve.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Tony in Evansville. Hi to you.
Good morning. I've got a question about bats that I guess I have somewhat of a bat problem in my home, although I don't want, I like the bats when they're not in my house. My house is a brick house, I guess what I'd call a veneer brick, and the bats are getting up under the fascia board along the roof line, and then down between the brick and in the interior, there's a, it's a boards that, between the studs. They can get in, they don't get into the house itself, but they get into the attic, leaving quite a bit of droppings. And but I noticed that I don't see much of the bats after, well, in the last two falls. It's still decent weather, but no longer do I could stand outside and watch the bats come out of the house in the evening, and I don't see that, I'm trying to think, you know, into September, October, when it's still decent weather.
Right.
And then I don't see them back again in the spring right away. So my thoughts were to this spring, as soon as it's, actually I could have probably done it all winter, this winter, but start working on sealing up along the fascia and in the areas where I've seen them come in and out. But if they're actually hibernating in the cavity between the brick and the wood part of the house, I don't want to lock them in because they can get into the attic, and now I've counted as many as 90 to 120 bats come out in the evening.
Wow.
Do some bats leave? I'm in southern Wisconsin, Evansville, rather than hibernate right in the area they live in the summer?
Most do. The only species that will stay, and sounds like you're behind your brick, is a great hibernating location for big brown bats. So they would be the only ones that would possibly stay there over winter. I would say best bet for you is to watch when they start moving in the spring and then find out exactly where all the locations are that they're coming in and leaving, and then put up a one-way exclusion door. That lets the bats out but not back in. You give it a week, and then you can seal up the holes. On our website, we've got instructions for how to do that. And if you don't want to do it yourself, you can hire a bat exclusion professional.
One other question. They get in, our house is peaked on the east and the west side. That's the tallest point. A lot of them were in and out a couple years ago on the west side. I now rarely see, if ever, any going in and out on that side. Is it possible they've, I guess I'm assuming perhaps they've filled up that cavity with their droppings and don't like that side anymore because they've seemed to move to the, more to the east side.
They usually move based on temperature. I don't think they would fill up a hole with droppings. And when you do an exclusion, you got to look for all holes because if you exclude their favorite one, they'll find their second favorite one. May take 2 years to figure it out, but it is possible, and that's pretty much the only way you can do it. You can't just go in there, take the bats out, drive them 100 miles away, and let them go because they've got great homing instincts, and they will be probably back before you
even get back.
Yeah.
There you go.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And I'm just looking at our Facebook page, and there's a great skeleton of a bat. Wes sent the photo in from Trempealeau, Wisconsin. So take a look at that. It's a skeleton of a bat found in a windowsill. And I don't know if you could get much better, a more perfect skeleton.
That's a great skeleton. Can I have it?
Yeah. I don't know. You're going to have to talk to Wes. Wes might be willing to part with it. You never, or he might not. It might not even be his. I'm not sure where it is. It could well be at a museum or something. But man, it's worth a look at. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can see that photo.
Yeah, it's a nice skeleton where it's all articulated, connected. So usually, when they dissolve, their bones are everywhere, and you just see the head here and forearm there. And excellent skeleton.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff in Pittsville has a question for you. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Hey, quick question for you. I know that bees, honeybees, are day activity critters, and bats are night. But there's times in the evening when bees and bats are both out. do bats eat bees or anything like that?
Do they eat bees?
Well, you're right on about typically not meeting day and night differences. I wouldn't say it's impossible that they would eat a few here and there, but I doubt it. Bats have the unusual ability to determine in the returning echo what species of insect it is. So if it's something, I mean, it's so
amazing.
Detailed, they can pick out what species of insect it is. And I'm not sure what a honeybee sting would do to a bat mouth, but it's tough to say. I would say it's not impossible to happen, but it's probably unlikely, if ever.
They don't go into any hives or, you know.
No, they wouldn't do that.
Okay, well, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks a lot for calling. Kim in Black Earth, your turn now. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I just wanted to say that we need to remember how important bats are. And so if they become pests in any way, preserve them in every way, because they're so threatened right now. We had lived in a 175-year-old log cabin home and 100 acres of land, and we had this bat get in our home, and apparently they lived up in our ivory tower of areas that, you know, had holes in there. And one got inside the house one time, and he was absolutely adorable. Yeah, you know, you have to be careful. They're wild. But he was complaining the whole time he hung on to one of the walls, the log cabin walls, you know, because he was trying to find his little place to get out, you know, from our danger.
Mm-hmm.
And we just put a trash can over him, and we were very, very gentle with him, and we released him. Whether he got back in or not, we didn't care. So we have to seal our homes and make sure we're faithful, you know, even if it's a pain, but not to exterminate any of these little creatures. I think Wisconsin's very fortunate to have them even in their midst.
Good points, I think, and I'm pretty sure, Dave, you'd agree with that.
Yes, very important animals, and I think everybody's favorite flighted mammal.
All right, that's a good way to put it. Andrea posted on Facebook with a link. There's a bat festival here in Madison on May 12th at Werner Park Community Center. The Bat House Building Workshop, where you can make your own bat house. And that's it's posted on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, so you can go to that and find that. So that's coming up May 12th.
Yeah, that's going to be a great event for the family. We're going to have stuff for all age groups. We're going to have bats from around the world, the largest bat in the world with a 6-foot wingspan. Other fruit-eating bats, Wisconsin bats, even some vampire bats there. And we've got a couple of different speakers. Author-illustrator Brian Lees has done a bunch of bat books, will be there. So come check it out. It's a fundraiser for the Bat Fund and also a great time for the family to come out and see and learn about bats.
And also, Kathy posted on Facebook with a link, by the way. She says people can also donate to the Endangered Resources Fund online, and she puts a link on to the online place. Either that option or the matching funds. She doesn't feel like it's been publicized enough, and wishes we'd publicize it more, Lori. And it's
I like Kathy, and agreed. And thank you for her help in publicizing it. As a matter of fact, every time a direct gift comes online or through the tax checkoff. As I mentioned, it's matched dollar to dollar up to $500,000. And if we don't get $500,000 in any one year, we don't get that. We just get what we receive, in other words. So really appreciate that plug for the program. It's kind of an odd state program in that so much of our budget depends on the beneficence of our citizens.
Yep.
So it's heartening to know that so many people care.
You can join in, too, by the way, with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Kirk in Elroy, Wisconsin. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, Larry. I'm building bat houses to replace the ones that have fallen apart on the farm. And so I went to the web and got the Bat Conservation International's nursery house design. In it, they suggest putting 2 coats of black water-based stain on the interior surfaces. I got two questions there. What's the purpose, and aren't we worried about toxicity?
Oh, it's a water base.
Yeah, good question. I've done it that way, and I've done it the other way of not putting any on. Using the water-based is what you have to do, and I believe their intent is to try and limit warping. You know, just it's okay. A method of treating the wood. So, as you know, when a bat house has been up over the years, it gets a little warped and rotted. Needs some maintenance, but that's one way to try and minimize that.
All right, and then that goes to the outside. We had tar paper on the old bat houses and then some rolled roofing nailed to it. They say here simply to paint it or stain it.
Yes.
And that's the preferred method nowadays?
Yeah, that's the way we do it. Paint it a dark color, dark brown or black even. And if you've had success where your old houses were, put them right back in the same location.
I intend to before spring here, yeah.
Yeah, good enough.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Email from Greg. Any updates on the impacts of wind farms and bats? Is there, you know, the danger from actual collisions or the pressure differences or the sound? Or are most of these towers high enough to avoid bat activity?
No, there is there's some interaction between bats and wind farms. Typically, the higher fatalities are with the larger turbines. Some bats aren't even hitting the turbines. There's a pressure drop behind the blades, it's known as barrel trauma, where the insides of the bat fill with fluid, the organs, and it's like bat bends, they call it, like divers. So that's, what was the rest?
Well, I was just wondering about danger from collisions and so forth.
Oh. Yeah, it's something.
And so, do we have any data on the impact of them?
Yes, we're throughout the country. They've been studying this for a while and are looking at ways to minimize it. And I think we're on the right track to figuring out how to make sure both can live on the landscape at the same time.
Jack in Madison, we are moving to you next. Hi, Jack. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have a question for Lori about funding sources for endangered resources. I'm aware of the tax checkoff and the license plates, and I have a wolf plate, but you mentioned a badger plate, and I'm not aware of that one. Is there a place we can go to get a look at it, and how do we go about getting one if we're interested?
Probably the DOT, I would think.
As a matter of fact, if you go to the DNR website, we've got a new website, and just put ER in the search engine, you go right to our page, and it goes to all of those different abilities to contribute and become a part of the Endangered Resources Program. And thank you for asking about the badger plate. It's a lovely plate. It's full color. It uses a different technology called flat plate technology. Mm. They've got them in Minnesota, and they're outselling us in Minnesota, so we want to stop that. And so you go right to the site, to the ER site, and we are hoping this year actually to unveil a new one, a great blue heron plate, to attract bird watchers as well. So, and every year then when you go back to register your car, you give a donation to the Endangered Resources Fund, and 100% of that donation goes to, none of it goes to overhead, 100% of it goes to Dave and his bats and all the other kind of good work.
I've always proposed for the bat license plate,
yeah,
you know, so
it's
everyone.
It's a cuddly animal, everyone loves it.
Everyone could have their own Batmobile. It would sell a lot better.
It was $25, isn't it?
Yes.
But can you deduct that off your taxes or not?
No, that is not a donation because you get the plate.
Because
right.
you get something for it. Okay. There you go, Jack.
Thank you, Jack.
Great show.
Yeah, thank you very much. I've got to look into the Badger one, too, to add to my collection. I've got a cool license plate number. So the Badger might go really well with the rest of it. Dave in New London, hi.
Intriguing.
Hi there. Great subject. My question is how do you track bats? I have bat houses. I have hung shutters on my buildings, and I can't seem to track any bats at all.
Yeah, great question. Everyone always wants to know how to attract them. You put up their house and have the idea if you build it, they will come. And it all comes down to location and how close to water source are you?
Probably 2 to, well, maybe longer than that. Probably 4 to 5 miles from the Wolf River.
Okay, and that's, there's no farm ponds or anything nearby?
No. No, swamp, there's swampland. I live by the Lebanon Swamp.
Okay, have you seen bats in your yard before?
Well, I've seen bats, you know, at dusk flying around, and they just don't like to hang out on my property, I guess, or live in my houses and stuff. So.
Okay, so you've had bat houses up for a while?
Yes, I've had this property for about 14 years. And
okay. It may be that the design of the house is not correct. Maybe it's too drafty. Maybe it's not located high enough. Maybe there's too much wind. Maybe there's too many overhanging branches nearby. I would go to our website and check out Bat House guidebook, and that tells you everything about what kind of house is needed, where to put it, and what your best chances of success are. There's really nothing you can do to attract them other than
provide, have it there, and
provide the
maybe
best
if
spot
they
for
see
them.
It, they will come.
Yeah.
And we, and sort of to close out here, Laura, we've got all kinds of opportunities for people to contribute. We certainly the check off, I do that every year on my income taxes, and look for the loon.
Right.
And we've got the license plates.
Correct. 2 different kinds.
Which I'm going to have to look at the Badger.
You are. You'll love it.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen it. So I've got to take. Is it brand new?
Within the last 2 years.
Oh, my goodness. I should have seen it by this time.
Don't forget the Bat Fund.
And the Bat Fund.
And the Bat Fest.
Yep. And the Bat Fest. And I tell you what, if you go to the Endangered Resources, if you go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, you'll get hooked right to the Endangered Resources Program. You can also, if you want to make a donation, you can do it right off. You can go to the link there and make your donation right there. And we'll be talking about some other endangered species and resources as the year goes on. Mm-hmm. Lori and Dave, thanks so much for kicking it off with us.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it very much. Every month, we're going to zero in on an endangered, something from the Endangered Resources program, starting with bats, and we'll be doing some others as well. And it'll always be on a Wednesday. And we're really looking forward to doing this for the whole year. Coming up, we've been talking about some of our more mysterious animal neighbors of the bats, but now we're going to switch to maybe something more familiar for you, but maybe not. But they're fascinating animals anyway. Sheep. We'll talk about raising them and cheese, sheep's milk cheese, a whole lot more. Coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.